This is Jesse Zurawell and Perspective on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I am Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. And my guest today is none other than Alex Craner, a good friend of the show. Alex is a former hedge fund manager. He's worked as a market analyst and has traded financial and commodity derivatives for over 20 years. He is the creator of the iSystem and founder of iSystem Trend Following. He is also the founder of Craner Analytics and the author of numerous books, including most recently, Grand Deception. He's also a very astute, very insightful, not just economics and financial analyst, but geopolitical analyst as well. And at his website, thenakedhedgie.com, he recently published a new piece called Russia Derangement Syndrome Confounds Western Thinking, which, if ever there was a true statement about what's going on in Ukraine and what's going on between Russia, Ukraine, and Western Empire, there you have it. So I'd like to get into a lot with Alex today. A lot has happened since we've last spoken. So without further ado, Alex, welcome back to Perspective. It's good to have you with me today.
Hi, Jesse. Thank you for having me. It's good to connect always.
Absolutely. So in preparing for our discussion today, I was racking my brain as to where to start because so much has happened, as I said, since you and I last spoke, and so much is happening by the day. And this seems to be intentional in a way. The news and the attendant propaganda seems to be coming at an unprecedented velocity and in an unprecedented quantity. So again, it was hard for me to figure out where to start, but I think a good place to start would be with Ukraine. And perhaps we can talk a little bit about your recent piece, which I just mentioned, which gets into the economics, the developing economic situation in Russia in particular, and in Western Empire in particular, the EU. But I just wanted to lay out a few things to lead us into the discussion. So on the ground, Russia is making substantial gains in the east. It's captured almost all of the Donbass. It's captured or taken control, I should say, of Kherson as well, which is in the south, very close to the Black Sea. And the Kiev regime controls much of the country still. But as far as Russia's military objective in taking control of the DPR and stopping the genocide there, it seems to be on a path to success. But at the same time, the Kiev regime is continuing to be armed by Western Empire. There are soldiers we know being trained in countries adjacent to Ukraine, including Poland. And Scott Ritter, whom I'm sure you're familiar with, pointed out that as long as the Kiev regime keeps reconstituting itself and coming back into the field with better weaponry than before and better training than before, it's going to be more difficult for Russia to meet both its military and its political objectives in this conflict. So to start, I want to get your take on that, the situation on the ground as best as you can assess it from where you're at.
Well, I think you're correct in saying that the Russian military campaign has proven extraordinarily successful. I think that for people, it might be hard to believe since, you know, the mainstream media has paraded an endless conveyor belt of these supposed military experts who have latched onto any minor success of the Ukrainian forces, lionized them, you know, presented them as these superhero fighters for freedom. And at the same time, ignoring or diminishing every success of the Russian forces, and also, you know, denigrating them as, you know, inept, conscripts, low morale, disarray, all of these things. So now, all of a sudden, you know, we have a whole array of politicians, military leaders, and even now, media people who are calling for urgent ceasefire and a negotiated settlement. We had, you know, Mario Draghi 2 weeks ago in Washington, D.C., urging for an immediate ceasefire. The French, the German leaders, we had General Mark Milley calling his counterpart in Russia. We had Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin call his counterpart in Russia, all with the same message. Can we talk? Can you stop the fighting? You know, so, you know, clearly the writing's on the wall. The Russians have prevailed. And not only have
and also but the war criminal who will never die, Henry Kissinger, came out with a statement at the World Economic Forum gathering this week.
Yes, exactly. So, and now we even had an op-ed in what was it, Washington Post or New York Times, essentially conceding the same, that, you know, it's game over. Ukrainians have lost. So basically it's Ukrainian army that's now in disarray. It's Ukrainian soldiers that are, you know, that their morale is on the floor and they're surrendering in droves. And so now it's a question of Russia consolidating its gains. We'll see what they do next. I don't know. You know, it's a question of whether they're going to go for Odessa and then take the whole of the Black Sea coast of Ukraine and leave Ukraine landlocked, basically. I suspect that they will not go for Kiev, you know, that they will not try to take the whole country, but that they will essentially... My reading of the situation is that they will let the defeated regime collapse on itself, because I think it's ready for that. You know, like, there's still the political process where, you know, people who have been brutalized by this, whose standard of livings have taken a dramatic drop even after they've been very low to begin with. They're not going to tolerate this corrupt puppet regime that's acting on behalf of its foreign sponsors. So maybe the Russians are figuring, we're not going to go fight for, you know, Kiev. We're just going to let the political process take its course in Ukraine. And then when there's a new government, maybe they negotiate, you know, and they, you know, like, they say, okay, you're going now, you know, we need you to be a neutral country. You know, and your security will be guaranteed by whatever, Russia and EU, or Russia or NATO, or Russia and the United States, and then consolidate what they've gained so far. We've seen that the Russians have opened the possibility for Russian-speaking people in Ukraine to take Russian passports in the territories that they have acquired. And that the people are starting to, the Russian ruble is starting to circulate. Massive convoys are trucks are bringing humanitarian aid and construction equipment for rebuilding what has been destroyed. And so, you know, everybody who's been talking about Afghanistan, you know, from the 1980s, how Russia is going to be dragged into a quagmire, it's going to be a complete disaster and so forth, they forget that there's another model that they could talk about, and that's Chechnya, you know, where Russia has also prosecuted a very painful, long, difficult war, prevailed, and today Chechnya is a peaceful republic that's living at its most prosperous it's ever been in its whole history. So, you know, it's it's not everything is Afghanistan, you know, and not everything you don't like is a Soviet military. And then with regards to the armaments that are being shipped by the West to Ukraine, and for which they're training the Ukrainian troops wherever in the west of Ukraine, in Poland, I've listened to a number of military analysts, you know, including Scott Ritter, but also Andrei Martyanov and the Dresden guy. And my understanding, I served in the military. I was an artilleryman, but I don't know these pieces of equipment that the Americans are sending over. And basically, there's a huge problem with these. That first of all, you know, Ukrainians don't have the air cover. So even if they bring these artillery pieces, so we're talking about that howitzer M777, I think, that they shipped, I don't know how many of them from the US. Right. It's not a self-propelled it's not a mobile piece of equipment. It's not self-propelled. It has to be towed by a truck, and it's a truck on tires, you know, not on the treads. And so they can only move on roads, and it, you know, once they fire around, then these anti-battery radars catch the location of the battery, and then they can immediately send the air force or helicopters, or they can target them with their own artillery. So what the Ukrainians would have to do is to set up this equipment, fire a round or two or three, and then quickly pack up again and then drive off. But now they have to drive on the roads, so they're easy to spot, you know, like they're not just wherever, they're on some road nearby, so they're going to be found out very quickly. And I think that the result of this, the Russians have been very, very successful at destroying this equipment, and it hasn't turned the tide of the war at all. It hasn't moved the dial almost even a little bit, because for these pieces of equipment, these howitzers, to be truly effective, you need the whole logistics supply chain to function correctly. You need air cover to protect them, to prevent them from being destroyed rapidly. And they would need to be self-propelled so they can go across all terrain rather than being towed on trucks along, you know, the roads where they can be easily spotted and destroyed. So, you know, it's a lot of posturing by the West. We're sending weapons and so forth, but it's too little, too late, and it's not going to change the situation.
Well, thank you for that explanation, because I don't have military experience. I only know what I engage with through my research. And when I hear somebody like Scott Ritter speak, who obviously has a lot of military experience, and he's somebody whose analyses I appreciate and respect, although I don't always agree with him, particularly when it comes to his points on West Asia, or the Middle East, as some people call it. But when he speaks about what's going on with regard to Russia and Ukraine, I feel as though he is pretty on point and has been pretty on point in his assessments. So recently, when he has appeared less optimistic in his assessments with regards to Russia's both military and political victories, I wasn't necessarily surprised, but, you know, it's something that I wanted to investigate further. So I appreciate you, as someone who also has military experience, providing that context. So we have to take a break in a minute, but I just want to ask you before we do, how do you think these weapons are getting into Ukraine? Where do you think the rat line is?
I think they're being flown to Poland. I think, you know, like there's been reports of many of these American U.S. Air Force cargo planes flying into, I forget the name of the town, but it's east, southeastern Poland. And I think that they're delivering military equipment and flying back out.
Yes, that's what I suspected as well. Okay, so we're going to throw it to a quick break and bore with Alex Craner after this.
TNT Radio's Rick Munn.
Where it's almost like it's the devil's own award ceremony. You know, they're demons rewarding demons with prizes, you know. A hotter spot in hell for the best and most effective vaccine. You know, Pfizer got this and Moderna got that. That's what it is, you know. That's really what it is. If people could actually see what this is, if they had eyes to see, they would see what this is. It's not something that's beneficial to the world. And this business of this plan that you talked about as well, and I concur 100%, it's not a case of, okay, you get your two shots, we're done with you. No, this is going to be a constant, regular thing. Do not fall for the lie that was told 2 years ago. Like, you take your two shots, you've stepped up to the plate, you're a patriot, you'll be safe, you won't transmit, everyone can go back to normal. No, you need your first booster shot, you need your second booster shot, you're going to need an annual shot with a flu shot, your children are going to have to get these shots even though there's no risk to them.
Locked and Loaded with Rick Munn on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Unlike other health concerns, mental illness is not always easy to see. Depression won't show up on an eye chart, and you won't find PTSD by looking at a thermometer. Sorting out a mental health concern takes professional diagnosis and treatment. Anxiety won't just go away under a bandage. If you or a loved one has a mental health concern, call 1-800-662-HELP for free and confidential information and treatment referral. Learn more at samhsa.gov/support.
This is it. Your chance to come face to face with a Royal Marines Commando. They've set you a mission, so you will need to listen to the following instructions very carefully. Meet at the rendezvous. The Royal Marine Commandos will be there waiting for you. Locate them, talk to them, and learn about what it takes to become a Royal Marines Commando. To find out more details about this secret mission, call 0117-926-0233. Got that? 0117-926-0233. However, you should be aware, complete this mission and your future missions will be a lot more challenging. Royal Marine Commandos. 99.99% need not apply.
Where progress is influenced by revolution and evolution. This is today's News Talk Radio.
TNT.
TNT.
Welcome back to Perspective. I am your host, Jesse Zerwell, and I'm speaking with a good friend of the show, Alex Craner. So, Alex, yesterday, the World Economic Forum's annual meeting in Davos wrapped up. And toward the beginning of that, we saw Zelensky appear on screen. Apparently, he's still on his virtual world tour, speaking tour. And he said to the crowd gathered at Davos, which included the Klitschko brothers, one of whom is the current mayor of Kiev and a former professional boxer, if I'm not mistaken. He not so much appealed to this crowd as demanded of them that, quote, maximum, unquote, sanctions on Russia be applied. And at the same time as this, we saw Kulebo, who's, I believe, the Kiev regime's foreign minister, say that NATO has not done enough to help Ukraine. And we also saw Arestovich, or Arestovich, depending on how you like to pronounce his last name, who is Zelensky's chief advisor, come out in a rant on Ukrainian television, a curse-filled rant toward those who were saying that perhaps Ukraine should throw in the towel. So it seems that we are indeed dealing with petulant child puppets here, and their demands were already beyond excessive, and they're only still going with that. So I'd like to get your reaction to what Zelensky, what Kulebo, what Arestovich, what these top players or top puppets, I think is more appropriate, in the Kiev regime have been saying to the West?
Look, my impression is that these boys have been set up to fail. You know, they've been used as puppets to carry water for the Western Empire on a long shot bet that they would be able to successfully pull Russia into a trap, to pull her into a quagmire, to weaken and destabilize Russia, and hopefully trigger a domino effect that eventually might lead to a regime change in Russia and the breakup of Russia into smaller, weaker entities that would all become subservient clients of the empire. So that's what these boys were used for. Of course, had the game been successful, they were promised probably rewards and riches and power and influence and money and, you know, mansions in Florida and, you know, yachts in the Mediterranean and all this. So obviously they were willing to gamble the lives of their compatriots. They were willing to shove tens of thousands of Ukrainian conscripts and soldiers into the meat grinder for the purpose of this project. But now it's clear that it has failed. And the Western, you know, the amazing Western show of unity was obviously going to come apart and is now very obviously coming apart. Nobody mm-hmm. has the conviction, except maybe Ursula von der Leyen, who I think lives on a different planet from everybody else. And so yes. I think that Arestovich, Zelensky, Kuleba, and people like them are starting to suspect that they're going to be thrown under the bus. That, you know, like if Henry Kissinger says that Ukraine has to negotiate an end to this, even at the cost of ceding territory, you know, it means that maybe grown-ups are going to have to take care of business, and these boys will probably end up accountable for what they have done. If not mm-hmm. to the Russians, then definitely to the Ukrainian people. And, you know, I think my understanding is that Zelensky has taken Israeli citizenship and passport, and his parents are already living there. They purchased like an $8 million house somewhere in Israel. Yes. So maybe Zelensky has a plan B and an insurance policy. Other people mm-hmm. maybe don't have, you know, maybe Arestovich doesn't have an insurance policy. I don't know. But, you know, now we're coming to the fight when the, you know, like when the cornered rats start lashing out at each other. Mm-hmm. And we might see, you know, like maybe this is why Russians don't feel pressure to go and take Kiev. You know, maybe these people are going to take care of themselves for them.
Right. Yes, I suspect that will be the case, because as you said, we're dealing with boys here. They are children. You can see that in every word they speak, every action they take. And it's laughable when you look at how Russia's officials, both military and political, conduct themselves, and then how Ukraine's military and political officials conduct themselves. There's no comparison, and that's objectively speaking, any fair-minded observer has to concede that. But I wonder what this bodes for the Nazis in Ukraine, because as far as I know, the SBU is still intact and has long since been infiltrated by Nazis. For example, Dmytro Yarosh, formerly of Right Sector or Pravi Sector. And the other sort of top Nazis, the ones who don't flaunt themselves around with swastika tattoos or black sun tattoos, I wonder what the future holds for that apparatus, because at least part of it still seems to be intact despite the Azov surrender at Azovstal. So I'm curious what your take is on that Nazi apparatus that still, I think, in large part exists within Ukraine.
My suspicion is that they will, that many of them are going to be preserved, and that they're going to be maybe taken out of Ukraine to, you know, God knows, to Poland, to Canada, somewhere. Because I know even from the Balkans experience that the empire, and so now I'm, you know, like I like to always explain, I'm not talking necessarily about the United States, I'm talking about this network of vested interests that represent what's formerly British Empire, now its principal political and military muscle is the United States, but the empire is not the United States. It's kind of global. It originates from the British Empire. So
right.
It's from London, Washington, but also Ottawa, Paris, Berlin. You know, it's like the axis plus the assorted vassal states. So they, yeah, as a regular practice, they cultivate the extreme elements of nations that they intend to destabilize in the future, right? And so, you know, there was like when the wars broke out on the Balkans, it turned out that there was like quite an active community of you know, extreme right Croatians who, when things started going in the way of confrontation, were sent to Croatia, and they were sent to Croatia with the assignment of escalating tensions and making sure that there's a war. And mm-hmm. So, you know, we saw the same after World War II, that the United States and the Allies actually took a large number of Nazis to their own side and then continued to use them in their, you know, for military purposes, for scientific research, for weapons developments, and so on. So I think that mm-hmm. to the extent that these people are useful rather than a liability, they will be protected to the extent possible, and they will probably be withdrawn to safe areas, which may be, you know, Poland, Sweden, Canada, I don't know, wherever they might go. But that's mm-hmm. what I suspect will happen. Others, maybe, because I know that there's a lot of tension within the Ukrainian military, because, you know, you have the fanatical wing that are willing to go on suicidal missions, and then there are professional, you know, soldiers in the normal traditional way who look at things in a more objective way, and they say, like, maybe we shouldn't be fighting this in this way. So there have been reported serious fights between units of Ukrainian military, so internal fights, even to the point of assassinations. And I wouldn't be surprised if there's even a revolt among Ukrainian military, and that some of these extreme fanatics actually get apprehended by their own people. I mean, by, you know, by other Ukrainian troops.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it remains to be seen, but I've already seen multiple videos, and I can't independently confirm them, but they do seem to be genuine of Ukrainian, I don't know the official nomenclature of the grouping. I suppose you could say, let's just say squads of soldiers. Maybe you can correct me on what the right term is, but squads of Ukrainian soldiers, and these aren't Nazis. These are, as you said, regular, for lack of a better word, Ukrainian soldiers surrendering on video, providing a message of their surrender to the Kiev regime, and essentially conceding the futility of continuing the fight against Russia. And I've seen a handful of those, and I suspect there are many more out there. So, and once these individuals and their families and other Ukrainians who aren't combatants are sort of able to clear the dust and grit of war from their eyes and see what the Kiev regime and the Nazi elements that they're closest to have done to the country, I think there's a high possibility that they will turn on those entities. But you know, the protection of the valuable ones, the ones that that Western Empire sees as valuable, I see that highly likely as well. And what that bodes for Russia as far as Western Empire trying to keep its basically regime overthrow campaign against Russia going, I don't know. But it seems that not just militarily, but economically, and here I'd like to bring your latest piece into the discussion. Economically, Western Empire is kaput. I mean, I don't know where it's going to continue getting the financial resources to carry this on. I mean, it's already provided, the US alone has already provided more to Ukraine than Russia's annual military budget. In a matter of months, the US has done that with $53 billion. And this is money the US doesn't have, as you and I have talked about. This is money that this is debt-based money that is being used to fund this. So, you know, I think that speaks to the title of your piece a bit, Russia Derangement Syndrome Confounds Western Thinking. So if we can get into the economics of what's happening here, you know, what does this bode in particular for Western Empire? Because the Russian ruble, as we see daily, is doing very well, and the exchange rate with regard to the dollar is, you know, it's only getting better for Russia, based on my observations. So, you know, and then we're seeing things like in France, for example, that the country cannot provide food for its citizens. You know, it's appealing to its citizens to start being self-reliant with regard to food provision, you know, to grow their own food, et cetera, because it can't import the food, at least in the quantities that it used to. So, and you know, whether this is a controlled demolition or not is a discussion to be had as well. But I want to get your take here on the economics of the situation, particularly with regard to Western Empire.
Well, I think for the Russia gambit, and you know, like let us not forget that the Western Empire has deliberately and premeditatedly provoked Russia into this war, and at some point, you know, the Russians decided to walk into a trap all the same. You know, we had explanations for why that is. I was among the people who thought that Russia would never do it because it was so obviously a trap. But, right. You know, as the OSCE observer Jacques Vaux explained, there was like a very sharp increase in artillery attacks on the Donbas from the Ukrainian military force, and so that indicated that they were preparing a major offensive, which is why Russia went in. Mm-hmm. I think that the gamble on the part of the Western Empire was that they maybe thought that they would trigger a sequence of events that would get Russia bogged down, that they would be able to collapse Russia's economy with sanctions, with blockades, with the, you know, confiscations of their foreign reserves and so forth. And that would have, you know, that would have had a very long-term positive, you know, had they been successful, had they been able to, you know, collapse Russia basically and get a regime changed and then get somebody into the Kremlin like their old pal Boris Yeltsin, that mm-hmm. long-term would have been a major bonanza for the empire's banks and corporations, you know, because they'd go in there and, you know, oh, look at this collapsed economy. You need our loans. And Russia has, mm-hmm. you know, like the whole thing that is needed to float up the Western financial system is collateral. If there's no collateral, then it's like an inverted pyramid that collapses on itself. And Russia right. is chock full of collateral, you know, like in terms of resources, educated work population, companies with low debt, the government that has merely like 18 or 19% debt to GDP, massive resources, massive reserves of gold. And so I think that economically, the West that was already going off the rails since, since 1971, basically, when Nixon took the United States off of the gold standard. But then, mm-hmm. You know, with these particular inflection point where the crisis was accelerating, like the Black Monday of 1987, and then Alan Greenspan starts the quantitative easing, the interventions in the stock market. Mm-hmm. And then the dot-com bust, and then the 2008 global great financial crisis, and then the unending, unprecedented mass-scale quantitative easing, which is just, you know, newspeak for printing money with no end. And so mm-hmm. the things are inevitably going to unravel in an inflationary collapse. And so, you know, defeating Russia would have been a bonanza longer term. And, you know, the longer term bonanza can already backstop the system short term if you know that it's there, you know, if people have confidence mm-hmm. that you're prevailing. It has all failed. It has all failed miserably. So it's only going to, accelerate the collapse. And I think that we can expect from our leaders to act as gamblers and try to double down on whatever they're trying to do. They're not going to call it all off and say, okay, right. we failed. Now we have to cut our losses and we have to put the society back on healthy foundations. They're just going to continue to run amok, I expect.
Yes, I do too. And the intentionality of that is something I'm constantly questioning. So we have to throw it to one more quick break, but I want to get your take on that when we come back and a few other points. So more with Alex Craner after this.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Jeremy Beck.
Much of the legacy media has emphasized former President Donald Trump's losses in the most recent series of Republican primary elections. The typical line is that Trump continues with a discredited lie that the 2020 presidential election was stolen. The establishment media celebrates losses of any Trump-endorsed candidate who has voiced concerns of widespread election fraud in 2020. But a look at the recent round of primaries shows that 11 candidates who voted to overturn the 2020 presidential election results were victorious. 7 of them were incumbent members of Congress who were unopposed and received large votes in their own right. 4 who were up against challengers all easily won. Mike Rogers in Alabama got 82%, Rick Crawford in Arkansas 75%, Andrew Clyde in Georgia 76%, and Marjorie Taylor Greene also in Georgia 70%. I'm Jeremy Beck for TNT Radio.
In many countries around the world, medical care is scarce. Countless millions have no access to safe surgery. Mercy Ships is there to help. Mercy Ships provides free surgeries for the thousands of those who are waiting for surgery at each port.
Mercy Ships is bringing services to countries that would otherwise never be able to access those services.
Find out how you can help by visiting our website at mercyships.org. That's mercyships.org.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Ukrainian President Zelensky is among five people named as recipients of the John F. Kennedy Profile in Courage Award for acting to protect democracy. President Zelensky was chosen because he has marshaled the spirit, patriotism, and untiring sacrifice of the Ukrainian people in a life-or-death fight for their country. The John F. Kennedy Library Foundation said, in response, journalist Gonzalo Lira asked, "So when you shut down opposition news channels, persecute journalists critical of you, imprison your political opponents, and in some cases have them murdered, that's defending democracy?"
Government has taken our rights and will never give them back unless we make them. The voice of freedom is TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Perspective. I am Jesse Zerwell, your host for the rest of the hour. And I've been speaking with good friend of the show, Alex Craner. And we've been talking primarily about Ukraine, the conflict there, and what it bodes for both Russia and Western Empire, which clearly, if you haven't been living in a cave for the past several months or even the past decade, has it out for Russia, to put it mildly. So Alex, before the break, we were talking about how economically Western Empire has essentially blown it with this gambit. And I wonder how much intentionality is behind that, because as we saw at the World Economic Forum's annual gathering this week, they were carrying on with the usual pontificating that they do, but it now seems more in line than ever. Things are lining up, I think, more seamlessly than ever before with regard to what the globalists want to put into play economically. So we saw talks. There was one titled Global ESG for Global Resilience, which of course has to do with environment sustainability goals, which is about this green economic delusion. There was a special address by Pedro Sanchez, who's the prime minister of Spain. I can tell you that another good friend of the show, Issa Blumi, who is a professor based in Stockholm, he was recently in Madrid, and he told me that so many businesses there have closed down permanently that he's really seeing what looks like a controlled economic demolition. We also saw the launch of a travel and tourism development index. Sandwiched in between all of this, Jens Stoltenberg made some remarks talking about harmony, of all things, the black irony of that. Don't let it be lost on you. And then, of course, we had John Kerry, Franz Timmermans, the usual suspects when it comes to climate change, talking about speeding up on the road to net zero. Mark Carney had something to say about this as well. And then to add to that, we have the shoehorning in of, the globalist health agenda, that war on our biological selves that's still continuing. So people like Bill Gates, Albert Bourla of Pfizer fame, they're still out there pushing this globalist takeover of quote unquote public health, which is all about control and financial gain. And, dovetails nicely with other agendas, particularly that of the international banking cartel, which, as you and I have discussed, is really at the top of all of this. So all that said, How much of what we've seen happening in Western empire with regard to its economic collapse, because that's really what it is, how much of that, in your estimation, is intentional, and how much is organic, so to speak, and perhaps being capitalized on by the globalists?
Well, I think that the agenda, the intent of these changes that are being planned and promoted and pushed forward is completely intentional. It's completely premeditated. It goes back decades. I know that I've read reports about, from people who have participated in various conferences during the 1980s and during the 1990s. You know, there was the Rio summit, I think climate summit, was it in 1992 or something like that?
Yep.
And there was already then, there was extensive talk about, the climate crisis, about many of these problems that the elites, quote unquote, intended to solve basically by taking much more tight control over the populations. And so I think that the things evolved and developed from there. I've done recently, a few months ago, I've done a video report about Theranos, because mm-hmm. that story caught my attention back in 2014, 2015, when the young CEO of Theranos, Elizabeth Holmes, was in the zenith of her fame and fortune. And I thought, right, there's something fishy about this thing, because her boards of directors were Henry Kissinger and General Mattis and George Shultz, the former Secretary of State under Ronald Reagan. And mm-hmm. the whole board of directors were deep state swamp creatures. No, medical doctors, no biochemists. It was all, but the company's intent was diagnosing disease, early diagnosing, right, of disease, everything through like a small device that would be networked and within 5 miles from every household. And so, when I got into that story, I realized that this was not, because to begin with, their technology didn't work at all.
Right.
They were hyping up something that was completely fake. Mm-hmm. They were advertising a technology that could diagnose 240 different diseases from a single drop of blood, whereas in reality, there wasn't even theoretical possibility of this technology to diagnose more than maybe 15, and mm-hmm. it maybe diagnosed 10 or 11, not reliably and not accurately. Okay, so it was, the whole thing was very fake. Well, Theranos was launched in 2003, right? It was launched in 2003, and the intent to build out this mega testing infrastructure, all connected to central servers, so that you could kind of conjure up fake pandemics by telling, you're having people coming in, testing their blood, and then they can, okay, let's have like an outburst, an outbreak of such and such disease in this country. It would be a very useful, it would be a very useful way to destabilize nations, because then you could say like, oh my God, you have to lock people down. You have to declare a pandemic. You have to close your borders and so forth. That's why this was being done. And that's the reason why everybody on the board of directors was not a doctor or biochemist or public health professional. They were all like people associated with the military, with the state, with the diplomacy, with the secret service agencies. Okay, so mm-hmm. the fact that this company was launched in 2003 indicates that they already did extensive preparations back then. The thinking the mindset and the plans were already then being slowly developed. Well, you know, 2003 was a long time ago. That was when, you know, the Soviet Union was Russia was an absolute mess. China was not nearly as wealthy and powerful as it is today. The United States was, drunk on hubris about the project of the new American century. I don't know if you remember that.
Yes, they went into
Afghanistan, they went into Iraq, and all these neocons that were clustered around this project of the new American century were convinced that they were just like, creating history as it suited them and as they decided, and there was nobody to oppose them because, you know, like one of the centerpieces of this project of the new American century was an indefinite full spectrum dominance that was, you know, that they were supposed to have over every nation, over every continent. So, taking that forward and getting ability to micromanage nations and populations was going to be done through pandemics. And this is not fantasy, you know, like there's like one or two OS 2013, and the title of one, it's the prevalence of infectious disease in a society, in a nation, with authoritarian rule. And the correlation is amazingly high. It's like 70%, which is in social sciences an unheard of correlation. You know, it's higher than the correlation between IQ scores and IQ and test scores. Okay, so that's like a very, very remarkable correlation for something like that. And so what that tells you is that, you know, if you want to have totalitarian rule over the world, then these nonstop rolling pandemics would be a very good way to do it, because, you know, you have this invisible enemy that could be anywhere. Anybody could have it. People are in fear. When people are in fear, they ask for more protection. To give them more protection, you need to take away civil liberties. You have to put them into this matrix of total control where, you know, something tracks you everywhere you go, where you're obliged to be on a regular vaccine schedule, where your liberties are conditioned with your compliance to all these health rules, because if you don't comply, then you're a threat to others, and then you can be taken out of the game, to put into like those isolation facilities like they had them built in Canada and Australia and so forth. So I think that this was the long-term agenda. I think it was entirely deliberate. Now, there is like a genuine element to it, because there are people who are genuinely afraid of these pandemics and of these viruses, and who believe when they're being told there's a pandemic and it's very dangerous and you're going to die if you don't do these things and you're going to kill grandma. And there are people who are genuinely worried about climate change, which is, you know, another invisible enemy that nobody can prove or disprove. But, you know, if you don't comply, you're destroying the planet. You're preventing good people from saving the planet.
Right.
So, you know, unending wars, invisible enemies, and nonstop propagation of fear and psychosis and alarm and emergencies are, I think, completely deliberate. And I think that some segment of the population cooperates with this simply because they don't realize that they're being manipulated and lied to. So, you know, the agenda as it's formulated, as it's planned, is completely deliberate and premeditated. But obviously it has to rely on participation and support from people who simply don't know any better and who think that they are doing the good thing because they're protecting others from disease and they're saving the planet from climate change and so forth.
Right. Yes, I absolutely agree. And just to give a quick example before we wrap up here, with regard to the monkeypox, smallpox scare. They've been gaming this since at least 1999, in which a smallpox attack scenario was carried out by Johns Hopkins. It was published in Emerging Infectious Diseases in 1999. This was under the auspices of the Center for Health Security.org. So, you know, what we're seeing now, this scare is intentional and planned, and we should not comply with it. We should resist it. Alex Craner, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it, and I look forward to speaking again very soon.
Thank you, Jesse. Pleasure to be with you.
Likewise. Take care.